Welcome back to the lab. Sources have been removed from this recording for compatibility with listening. Visit quantumdisciple.com to view the sources in detail. When Westerners hear the word Islam, we usually picture one thing. The evening news, we picture anger, we picture conflict, we picture men hiding in caves. That is a data error. If you actually sit down with a devout Muslim, you do not find chaos. You find discipline. You find a reverence for God that puts most Westerners to shame. You find hospitality. You find people who are genuinely trying to please the Creator by following the rules. But here's the question we need to ask. Are the rules the problem? I am not interested in the politics. I am a researcher interested in the architecture. Islam claims to be the final update to the Abrahamic faith, acting as software version 3.0. It claims to correct the errors of Judaism and Christianity. So I ran the diagnostic, I looked at the history, the claims about Jesus, and the logic of salvation, and I found a critical bug in the timeline. The ancient scriptures invite us with this quote, "Come now, let us reason together," end quote. Section 1.0, the framework, submission versus adoption. The word Islam means submission. The entire system is built on a master and servant architecture. God or Allah is the master. You are the servant. To maintain your standing, you must execute 5 specific duties known as the 5 pillars. These are not suggestions. They are requirements. Section 1.1. The requirements or the checklist. 1. The oath. The confession of faith stating there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his messenger. 2. The schedule, praying 5 times a day, facing Mecca at specific times. 3, the offering, a mandatory giving of a percentage of your wealth to the poor. 4, the discipline, fasting from food and water from sunrise to sunset during the month of Ramadan. 5, the journey, a once-in-a-lifetime pilgrimage to Mecca to perform specific rituals. The logic here is a transaction. It is a wage-based economy. If you perform the labor, you hope to earn the reward. But notice the direction of the effort. It moves from human to God. It is man trying to climb up to God by climbing a ladder of rules. Section 1.2. The Christian update. Adoption. Christianity operates on a gift-based economy. The Bible presents a relationship not of a master and a servant, but of a father and a son. Here's the logic check. An employee is valued based on performance. He has to hit his quotas. If he stops working, he loses his status. A son is valued based on birthright. He does not have to earn his last name. Even if he fails, he is still part of the family. Islam offers you a contract. Christianity offers you adoption papers. The difference is not just terminology, it is security. You can be fired from a job. You cannot be fired from a family. Section 2.0. The Jesus paradox, the super prophet. Most Westerners assume Islam minimizes Jesus. The opposite is true. Islam maximizes him, but then puts a ceiling on him. In the Quran, Jesus is not just a guy in sandals. He is a supernatural powerhouse. In fact, if you look at the credentials ascribed to Jesus in Islam, he actually possesses higher authority than Muhammad. Section 2.1. The miracles, the power of God. The Quran attributes miracles to Jesus that are staggering. He isn't just delivering a message. He is altering the laws of nature. He spoke as a baby. While still in the cradle, he spoke in full sentences to defend his mother's honor. He cured the incurable. He healed the blind and the lepers. He raised the dead. He brought dead people back to life by Allah's permission. He created life. This is the big one. The text says Jesus formed a bird out of clay, breathed into it, and it became a real living bird. The logic check reveals that in theology, creation is a function reserved for God alone. Prophets deliver mail. They do not generate life. By admitting Jesus could breathe life into dead clay, Islam acknowledges he has the power of a creator. Section 2.2. The second coming, the judge. Here is the plot twist most Christians do not know. Muslims are waiting for the return of Jesus too. In Islamic theology, it is not Muhammad who returns to save the world in the end times. It is Jesus. They believe Jesus is currently alive in heaven since he did not die on the cross. In the last days, he will descend physically to Damascus to defeat the Antichrist. But here is the catch. They believe he is coming back to correct the Christians. The Islamic traditions teach that he will break the crosses, kill the swine, and tell the world, quote, "I never said I was God," end quote. Section 2.3, the organizational chart problem. This brings us to the logical breaking point. If you remove the names and just look at the resumes provided by the Quran, the hierarchy becomes confusing. Compare the two profiles according to Islamic theology. Profile A, representing Muhammad, born naturally, sinned and was told to ask for forgiveness, died in Medina, is currently in a grave waiting for the day of judgment. Profile B, representing Jesus, born of a virgin, lived a sinless life, performed miracles, did not die but was raised alive to heaven, is currently with God and will return to judge the world. The logical conclusion is that Islam insists Profile A is the greatest of all prophets, but the data shows that Profile B possesses the attributes of the divine. Part 2, Section 3.0, the historical data conflict, the cross. This is the single biggest data error between the two systems. History says Jesus of Nazareth died on a Roman cross and was buried. The Quran says it looked like him, but it was not him. The claim states, quote, "They did not kill him, nor did they crucify him, but it was made to appear to them so," end quote. The standard Islamic interpretation is the substitution theory. This proposes that Allah miraculously switched Jesus' face with someone else, perhaps Judas, moments before the arrest. Section 3.1, the death records, external verification. First, we must establish that a crucifixion actually happened. We do not just have the Bible. We have a cloud of witnesses from hostile and indifferent sources. Cornelius Tacitus, a Roman historian writing early in the second century, confirms that Christ suffered the extreme penalty of crucifixion during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of Pontius Pilate. Flavius Josephus, a non-Christian Jewish historian from the first century, records that Pilate condemned him to the cross. The Jewish Talmud records that Jesus was hanged, which was a term used for crucifixion, on the eve of the Passover because he practiced sorcery. The logic check shows that all three major groups, Romans, Jews, and Christians, agree that Jesus was crucified. The only book that disagrees was written 600 years later, hundreds of miles away. Section 3.2, the identity check, the mother variable. The Quran claims the person on the cross was an imposter, but this theory ignores the most critical witness at the scene, his mother. The historical record shows that Mary stood at the foot of the cross. The logic is simple. A mother knows her son. She knows his scars, his voice, his eyes. The implication is profound. If Allah switched Jesus with Judas, he did not just trick the Romans. He tricked Mary. This introduces a difficult variable. If the substitution theory is true, it means the Creator performed a miracle to make a faithful mother believe she was watching her own son be tortured to death. She mourned a lie. We have to ask ourselves, does this level of deception align with the character of the God of truth? Section 3.3, the resurrection, the empty tomb. Did anyone see him afterward? While we do not have a Roman letter saying they saw a ghost, we have a massive piece of data from the enemy side. The missing body. When the disciples started claiming Jesus was alive, the Jewish authorities did not say he was still in the grave and produced the body. Instead, they claimed the disciples stole the body. This is a critical admission. By saying the body was stolen, the enemies admitted the tomb was empty. If the man on the cross was an imposter, his body would still be in the tomb. The Romans or Jews could have simply rolled out the corpse of the imposter to prove the resurrection was a lie. They didn't. They couldn't, because the tomb was empty. look at the eyewitness data. Within a few years of the event, the early church formalized a creed stating that Jesus appeared to Peter, to the 12 disciples, to 500 brothers at one time, to his skeptical brother James, and to his enemy Paul. People hallucinate alone. They do not hallucinate in groups of 500. And skeptics do not die for a hallucination. They died because they saw the data with their own eyes. Part 3, Section 4.0. The corruption theory, the broken chain. When you show a Muslim friend the Bible verses where Jesus claims to be God, they usually play their trump card claiming the Bible has been corrupted. The claim is that the original gospel was Islamic and taught that Jesus was just a man, but Christians changed the text later to make him a god. The logic failure here is simple. As a researcher, I look at data integrity. If you claim a document was changed, you have to answer a simple question. When did the change happen? Section 4.1, Scenario A, before Muhammad. If the Bible was already corrupted before Islam began in the 7th century, then the Quran has a major internal contradiction. The Quran repeatedly confirms the Torah and the gospel are from God. It even commands the Christians to judge by what Allah has revealed therein. The logic asks, why would God command Christians to judge by a book that was already filled with lies? If it was corrupted, he would have warned them against it, not told them to follow it. Section 4.2, Scenario B, the timeline problem. If the theory is that Christians changed the Bible after Islam arrived to hide the truth about Jesus, we run into a massive logistical hurdle. By the 7th century, the New Testament was not sitting in a single vault in Rome. It had already spread across the entire known world. There were thousands of copies circulating in Europe, Africa, and Asia. It was being read in Greek, Latin, Syriac, and Coptic. Consider the logistics of a change. Imagine trying to change the ending of a famous book that has already sold a million copies. To successfully alter the text, a conspirator would have to travel to every country and every church, confiscate every single scroll without anyone hiding one, destroy them all, write thousands of new fake Bibles, and put them back on the shelves without history ever recording that a great book swap took place. It simply could not be done. The message had already left the building. The reason all our ancient manuscripts match is because nobody could ever gather them all up to change them. Section 4.3, the time capsule proof. For centuries, skeptics had a fair question. How do we know the Old Testament was not changed over 1,000 years of copying? Then, in 1947, a shepherd threw a rock into a cave near the Dead Sea and heard a jar break. Inside, he found the Dead Sea Scrolls. These manuscripts dated back 100 to 200 years before Christ. That is hundreds of years before Jesus or Muhammad were even born. They had been sitting in a clay jar, untouched by human hands, for 2 millennia. The most famous find was a complete scroll of the book of Isaiah. When scholars unrolled it, they could compare an ancient copy with the Bible we use today. The results of the audit showed they were 95% identical. The text was word for word the same. The 5% variance consisted almost entirely of spelling changes or slips of the pen. The message was 100% intact. The smoking gun is the 53rd chapter of Isaiah. This is the critical data point. This chapter predicts the Messiah will be pierced for our transgressions and crushed for our iniquities. Skeptics used to claim Christians wrote this chapter after Jesus died to make it look like a prophecy. But the ancient scroll proves that this chapter was sitting in a jar a century before Jesus was born. The verdict is that the data has not drifted. The Bible you hold in your hand today is the same one the prophets wrote and the same one the Quran originally pointed to. The chain remains unbroken. Section 5.0, the exit protocol, the scales versus the guarantee. At the end of the day, every religious system is trying to answer one question: how do I survive the judgment? Section 5.1, Islam, the balance sheet. In Islam, your eternity is essentially an accounting problem. On the day of judgment, your deeds will be placed on a set of cosmic scales. On one side are your prayers, fasting, and charity. On the other side are your sins, anger, and failures. The logic is that if the good outweighs the bad, you might get in. But ultimately, it depends on the will of Allah. There is no guarantee. Even Muhammad himself said that no one will become entitled to paradise by his good deeds alone, not even himself, unless Allah wraps him in mercy. The risk creates a system of uncertainty. You can pray 5 times a day, fast every Ramadan, and give to the poor, and still stand at the grave wondering if you did enough. Section 5.2. Christianity, the substitute. Christianity takes a different view of the math. It admits that if you put your deeds on the scale, the bad side will hit the floor every time. The standard is perfection, and none of us are perfect. But instead of asking you to add more weights to the good side, the designer Jesus steps onto the scale for you. The logical difference is this. In Islam, you offer your life to God, hoping it is enough. In Christianity, God offered his life for you because he knew you weren't enough. One system ends with a question mark. I hope so. The other ends with a period. Quote, it is finished. End quote. Section 6.0. Conclusion. The silence gap. I respect the devotion of my Muslim friends. I really do. Their discipline is beautiful. But I have to look at the architecture of the systems they are trusting. System A, which is Islam, requires me to believe that God allowed the entire world, including Jesus' own mother and disciples, to believe he died on the cross. It requires me to believe that God waited 600 years before sending a correction. That means for 6 centuries, God let millions of people worship him based on a misunderstanding that he created. System B, which is Christianity, says God was not silent. It says he spoke clearly on the day it happened. It aligns with the history we can read and the empty tomb we can visit. One system says God waited 600 years to tell us the truth. The other says he told us the truth on day one. Quote, it is finished, end quote. The defense rests. Thank you for listening. Please like and subscribe and visit quantumdisciple.com for more Christian research. Quantum Disciple out.